So, Mr. Bell, could you tell me your full name and your date of birth?
My name is Ronald Leslie Bell. I was born in May the 11th, 1933.
And where were you born and raised?
I was born in what was at that time called Tientsin, China.
Oh, wow.
And I was basically raised in the United Kingdom in the vicinity of London.
Okay. And it sounds like you came from a military family.
No.
No, you didn't. Okay. What was the kind of business of your father?
Interesting. My father was with Dutch Shell Oil in Shanghai for a number of years. And my mother was the daughter of China Inland Missions.
Oh,
and so there were the two sides, like the missionary side and the business side.
Okay. And what sort of, you were educated in England then?
I was educated at what's called an English public school, a very famous one, called Christ's Hospital,
yeah.
Founded in 1553.
And you went up until grade 12 there, you finished?
Well, we finished.
Finished their
we,
level.
We didn't call it
yeah.
levels. I finished at, going to university level.
Okay. And when did you join the military?
In 1954.
And was that always an intention of yours?
Or? Not at all.
No?
Absolutely not. I left England in 1953. And in fact, hard to believe, I was, I didn't join up as we were, as you know, that there was conscription here
right.
in England during that period, because I was an asthmatic. And that made me what we called A3B, which means I could not join up. Which was good and bad, I guess. In any event, I came to Canada, and the change of climate and everything else, I never had asthma again.
Mm-hmm.
And after less than a year in Canada, someone had taken me up on an airplane, usual, and I enjoyed it so much, I said, I've got to try this. They were very short of people in the aviation side at the time, the Royal Canadian Air Force, so they quickly latched on to me. They told me I had some eye problems, astigmatism, and that I would be better as a navigator than I would be trying to train as a pilot. So I started off as a navigator.
And when did you come to Canada?
1953.
53, okay.
And joined the service in 1954.
Wow. And you went right into the Air Force?
I went right into the Royal Canadian Air Force.
And were trained... Initially as a pilot?
No.
Oh, no, never as a
right
pilot?
Right from the beginning as a navigator in Winnipeg.
What sort of training did you receive as a navigator?
For the first two-thirds of the training, you all trained the same, as if it didn't matter what you were going to be a navigator of. You trained to make sure that an aircraft could go from point A to point B
mm-hmm.
using all the available technology at the time, including astro-navigation. Using the stars and the sun and the moon and so on. And then after you finished with that period, you specialized, and I specialized and became an airborne intercept navigator, which meant I would be flying in high-speed interceptor jets with just myself and a pilot.
Okay. What type of planes were they?
In those days, it was the CF-100,
okay.
the Canuck.
Okay. And how long did you, it was ongoing training?
After you trained on the basic training, I went to Cold Lake as the first course on the CF-100 in Cold Lake in 1954. And it was what they call the operational training unit, where you transition from just basic training to learn how to fly the aircraft you'll be flying, or to use the facility of the aircraft for a squadron performance, operational training.
Okay, and so that's in 54 still, or are we later?
That was 54 or 55. It was 55 that, because it took a year of training almost to become the manager. And then the last part, the operational training was in 1955.
So what, in 55, 56, what was the Air Force working on? Were you assigned to any?
Yeah, I went to a squadron in near Montreal, mm-hmm. in Saint-Hubert, which was 425 Alouette Squadron. Mm-hmm. And I flew there or worked there because I moved while I was in the squadron for 4 years, from 55, 56 to 59.
Now, would these planes, they would fly on their own from the base, or would they fly
on
a carrier?
Yes, this aircraft is unique. It was the only airborne interceptor aircraft designed and built by Canadians. The other aircraft that we acquired in many cases were American airplanes, like the Sabre and so on. The Sabre was a single-seat fighter, which was used in Europe, basically, and in Korea. The CF-100 was initially designed to be an airborne interceptor in the air defense of Canada, albeit we sent them to Europe in the late 50s. But it was strictly designed by Canadians, built by Canadians, and it was a marvelous airplane.
So, specifically, what was the airborne interceptor navigator
job?
What were you...
Well, the interceptor, what were we intercepting? Well, this was during the Cold War, and the Soviet Union had a fairly formidable air force, quite capable of coming over North America from the Soviet Union. And we had very limited capability of stopping them doing that. And so we needed an aircraft that could do it, that was built by Canadians. In fact, during that period, from probably about 54 to 60 at least, the Canadian interceptor aircraft was better than anything the American had. And they were quite jealous of this particular aircraft. And the intent was that the Soviet Union, should they consider an attack on North America, would recognize that they did not get a free ride. They would be intercepted, and we would have knowledge of their arrival, and we would be prepared to shoot them down if they had to. We carried rockets and things on the airplane.
So you were looking specifically for some sort of Russian Soviet activity?
Yes. And we had ground radar stations, which you probably heard of, the Mid-Canada line and the Dew line and so on. And these were ground-based with rather large array radars that could look a couple of hundred miles. And they would be the early warning. And then through a connection of communications, that was fed through a headquarters. The headquarters would then advise the appropriate squadrons that there were aircraft coming into their sector and that we would take off under their control. And then at a certain point, a navigator in the back seat of these aircraft with his own radar would pick up, presumably, an enemy aircraft. And blindly, because you're doing it all on radar, you could go in, fire rockets, hopefully shoot the aircraft down and not even see it. It was all done in radar. So that's what we trained for. Never happened. But that's like an insurance policy.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what kind of ammunition did you carry?
We carried rockets in those days. There was nothing more formidable than that. But there were a hell of a lot of them. And if they got anywhere near you, they'd probably knock you out of the sky.
How many of the airborne interceptors were there, or the CF-100s, do you know?
How many in total? I can't remember the exact numbers. There were over 200.
Oh, really?
But in each squadron, you probably had about 18.
So when you were in Montreal, you would control a certain amount of...
Well, I was part of a squadron of 18 aircraft. And we all took turns to hold the quick reaction alert, which was you went down to a hangar on the end of the runway, and you slept there, two crews, and two aircraft were on alert all the time, and they were supposed to get into the air within 5 minutes. So you'd get the ding, and we'd roll out of bed
wake
at
up.
Any hour of the day or night, and you ran to your aircraft, jumped in, had the ground crew come and pull all the charts and things and do their checks, and away you'd go, and you'd be in the air more often than not in under 5 minutes.
And did you have a specific airspace that you would just over Quebec?
In fact, yeah, that's a good question. With all these radars spread around, each radar had, of course, a maximum range it worked in, and those sectors were controlled from the headquarters, if you want, to make sure that when an aircraft was coming out of one radar's coverage, it was then picked up by another and they passed to different squadrons.
So if you, for instance, had something on your radar, would you carry on if it went out of your sector? Or would you have to pass?
No. That's also an excellent question. And it would depend. If you were trying to shoot this thing down and was capable of doing it, they're not going to pull you off,
right,
honestly.
Right.
But if there was some doubt of fuel, you might be running short on fuel, or you might be in a long chase with a very slow closing speed, then it would be picked up.
How close, what sort of range would you have to be
with
it? Yeah.
With the rockets, pretty close. It was called, in the actual type of firing was called a lead collision. And the radars were a brilliant piece of mathematics, really. You would actually aim to hit the other, intercept the other aircraft, almost directly hitting it. But you would miss it by the distance the rockets would fly. So if the rockets flew, shall we say, a quarter of a mile in so long, and that's their optimum, then you would miss, it was actually about 300 feet, we would fly behind. So it would come like this, and you would actually see them. And I say you wouldn't see them quite often. It'd be pretty foggy not to see them.
Now, from their perspective, the Soviets would presumably be looking for you as well.
Yes.
Were you responsible for making sure that they were either not seeing you or having a hard time getting...
No, we didn't have electronic countermeasures. Basically, we were trying to counter whatever they had with countermeasures, which were very basic in those days. Wasn't a lot of electronic countermeasures, but it was building. And they had the capability. They were reasonably sophisticated.
The Soviets were?
Yes.
When you were trained, because you were in Cold War times, was that a big emphasis was put on what the Soviets had?
Oh.
You were really aware of machinery they were
We trained on the expectation that we knew what their tactics would be. And how they would operate. And so you learn as much as you can about that so that you would be in the best position to shoot the car. Mind you, we were all young, pretty young sprouts. I was older than most. I think I was 23. And there were kids of 19 and 20 coming on the squadron. They just wanted to fly airplanes.
So this would have been, presumably, they wouldn't have gone through themselves a war period. This would have been their first experience.
My experience was in the Second World War in London, just looking at the German bombers coming over, which we could see. That was the closest I got, but a lot of these kids, of course, that I was flying with had never been anywhere near a war, or even had relatives. So there were a lot of Canadians who were in the Second World War.
Was that a real, do you remember feeling that the Cold War was a real concern? Was there apprehension about it?
At times,
yeah.
At times, definitely, we were given a few frights that it was not just a game we were playing. You could get into that frame of mind and exercise yourself against your friends coming over, pretending to be. This often we would get a rude reminder of the reality of it.
So, if you can remember, in 62,
yes.
What position did you were?
I was doing a ground tour. After you had flown for so long, and I had flown from 1955 to almost 60, they gave you a rest, and that's putting you into a ground station. And many times, the kind of experience that I had, they put you in ground control radar, because I would be controlling the people that I had actually been flying with. So I had a very good concept of what was required. And I was, if not the first, very close to the first navigator who was sent overseas to be what they call a ground control intercept controller in Metz, France. at a very famous squadron called 61 ACMW in Norfolk, which was famous because the Canadians had the reputation for not having, only having probably the best radar equipment, which was British radar, but also the best controllers.
Of course. So
I was there at that time.
You were in France?
Yes.
Okay. And how many people would have been in France with you?
In 61 ACMW? I guess we had a complement of about 35, 40 perhaps.
And would that have been a combined, or it was strictly Air Force that was
there? It was strictly Air Force.
Okay. And what sort of planes did they have over there? The CF?
Oh, we remember I was in a radar site with this great thing, but we were flying at the time. We had a very strong complement in Europe. We had 12 Sabre squadrons, and that's 4-3s, and 8 or 12 CF-100 squadrons. It was big. Our contribution to NATO was fantastic.
Right.
There were four wings of Canadians, two in Germany, two in France. Mm-hmm. And we had CF-100 was the night or all weather airborne interceptor, and the day fighter, if you want, was the Sabre. Both very formidable, especially the Sabre.
So as part of the NATO organizations, would you take commands from NATO?
Yes.
They wouldn't be separate?
We came under the NATO control, although we had independent mm-hmm. commanders for each squadron. It was mm-hmm. a Canadian squadron, and when it got into the air, it came under NATO.
It does it seem
like that. Yeah.
Interesting. So when you were in France and were coming up to the crisis,
yes.
Was Cuba kind of on NATO's radar as a possibility?
I don't think many of us ever thought it would go to the way it did. I happened to be in Paris, actually, at the time when the crisis exploded with the declaration by President Kennedy, mm-hmm. step across this line and, you know, we go to war. And it's not going to be funny, it'll be nuclear. But we were concerned. I think most of us were concerned because being in a war area, and each day when the Sabres would go up and we were controlling them, we would actually follow them right to the edge of the Soviet zone.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to be careful they didn't go across, or we'd see the Soviet aircraft or their allies coming up. We could actually mm-hmm. see them coming up to meet if we transgress.
Yeah.
So that put us very much in the mind of what can happen. So I would say, yeah, there was concern.
Probably much more than when you were in Canada.
Very much.
Yeah.
Over, you're insulated by just sheer distance. But there, it was close to the real thing, and the recognition that something happened there, it's going to happen here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was an increased concern. There's no doubt about it.
Were you given any briefings once this all started to get underway in October, once Kennedy gave his speech? Were the NATO troops...
Interesting. They increased the alert status in Canada. I think they went to DEFCON 3.
Mm-hmm.
You know, off the bat, I can't remember exactly what happened in Europe, but they obviously raised the level of the alert.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it went beyond DEFCON 3, or even if it went to that, because we were under NATO direction as opposed to North America. I don't remember the defense condition we went to. I do remember being told to get back from Paris as soon as we could, which we did. I was actually sitting in the Lido nightclub in Paris at the time with my wife and a couple of other couples. And we actually participated in the show.
Mm-hmm.
There was a chap who was called Dominique, I remember, who was a pickpocket apart from other things, and he did suggestion stuff, and we were asked if we would participate before the show, and I had to sort of take my shirt off and put it so it could be pulled off, and someone had stuck his socks in his shoe, and the guy did an auto-suggestion thing and proved, you know, he did amazing things. And then suddenly, that about 11 o'clock that night, we had a waiter come to the table and say, well, I think it was Dominique's manager, and say, we're very sorry, Dominique. He looked to be rude, he didn't come and thank us. But there had been some very ominous news from the United States, and they told us about this crisis. And we, you know, it wasn't so much fun after that.
And so you were told to come back to Montreal?
Well, there was no way of telling us as such. We recognized, obviously, that we needed to get back.
To go back to France or to go back
to Metz.
There
was no trying to, hey, you can fly an airplane. No, because our job was just as important. Remember, that job on the ground was absolutely essential for getting those aircraft up and pointed to do that job should the Soviet Union invade. And there was always that potential. Very, very much so.
Once you returned back to Metz, what were you told to do? Do you remember what you were?
I believe we reviewed all our plans. It's the usual thing that you do in an emergency to see how we would operate if we did come into a crisis situation. But I really can't remember it specifically because to some extent we practiced that during the normal times as well. And interestingly enough, it didn't seem to change very much, which is probably good in some ways because obviously our training prepared, as far as our bosses were concerned, us to do the real thing.
Wasn't too much panic?
No, not at all. And the squadrons, I'm sure, were much the same way. They suddenly became aware that all this training now might be put to the test.
No, did your family live on the base?
No, they didn't. Lana was born in 62. We just had had a child. And my wife and I lived on the economy, as they call it, in that.
I had heard before that some people had been evacuated off bases.
They might have been. I didn't know that. The married quarters, possibly in Baden-Solingen and Zweibrücken, but I really can't see why.
And so basically, everybody went back and got on their stations.
Yes.
And were just
available and called in if necessary. There was any. Because you only have so many things you can do. I mean, you have a system with radar scopes and things that you're looking at. When you have a team, you can only put, maybe 12 people on there. So if you've got 30 people,
it's pointless.
So you keep them on the end of the telephone, so we give you a call. We're going to be operating on call 24 hours a day.
Be ready to relieve.
That's right.
Okay. So what happened? What did you see?
Well, we didn't see. I can't tell you whether I am building this in my mind or not. It seems to me that we got an increased response from our aircraft flying close to the border. Because we had an immensely long-range radar, as was this extraordinary radar.
On the ground.
Which we had this big reputation for, because it could look so far, and it could look into the German, Russian-occupied part of Germany, and south, too. And you could see their increased activity. And obviously, if we were going to fly our Sabres too close, they were going to be very, very... I think the feeling at the time, and here am I was only 28 or something, was you had to be very careful because you don't want to provoke. But at the same time, you want to let them know you're ready. And I'm sure there was a lot of that thinking going on, which I was not part of. I was a flight lieutenant at the time, which was not bad. I had two stripes. But I didn't make those decisions. But it was obviously a balance between letting each other know we're ready should we need to.
A lot of trying to determine what the other person's...
Yes, what your response would be. And also, we're here and we've got enough people to give you a hard time. And that was the way we played all the way through the Cold War. Mm-hmm.
So were tensions fairly high?
Yes.
That was...
Yes, I think there was a lot of apprehension. Mm-hmm. A sudden recognition that the Cold War wasn't just a fiction. Mm-hmm. It could get very hot. And if it got hot, it would get nuclear in a hurry. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall what it was that they said had triggered this, besides Kennedy's speech? Do you recall?
Well, we'd heard about the buildup of Cuba. Mm-hmm. But obviously, it was somewhat academic. Mm-hmm. And we never felt that Khrushchev would push it as much as he did. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was really seeing, again, perhaps what this response would be. We're talking about, but you don't play that with nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And he didn't appreciate perhaps the resolve of Kennedy. I think he misread it. Mm-hmm.
Were you, was NATO involved at all in any of those surveillance flying over Cuba at that time?
No, not at all. North Atlantic Treaty. Mm-hmm. It would have been strictly Americans. Are you talking about spy planes? Mm-hmm. U-2, strictly American. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So when they came forward with these photographs, mm-hmm, and this evidence, mm-hmm, that obviously was taken very seriously.
Very.
Is that something, does NATO conduct perhaps their own investigation into that? Or that?
We're talking about Cuba again? Mm-hmm. No, there was no independent capability. Mm-hmm. NATO is almost strictly Europe, but we obviously had the sea lanes with the North Atlantic Treaty. Mm-hmm. But that did not go down as far as Cuba. Mm-hmm. But the intelligence that was provided was obviously shared after a certain point. I think Americans withheld a lot. Again, because a panic could have ensued. Mm-hmm. Again, it's that balance.
Mm-hmm. Do you know at all from what was going on in Canada from any of the NATO stations that were there?
We didn't have any NATO stations.
Was there one in... Okay. Was there any affiliation with the Canadian forces at all and NATO, other than that weren't involved in specifically in NATO?
I don't quite understand what you mean. If you weren't affiliated with NATO, I mean, we had an affiliation. We were part of NATO, mm-hmm, which meant that we contributed to the forces basically in Europe, but obviously to some extent in the North Atlantic, because that was the North Atlantic Treaty. So there was shipping and ground and air support in, mm-hmm, Europe, but only the training would take place in Canada.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So there would be training in that sense, yes.
Okay. So do you recall how long were you on kind of your readiness alert in France?
We were always on an alert, but it was much lower key. If you're talking about very specifically to the Cuban crisis, I think that probably lasted a month, but I can't remember specifically, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, because once Khrushchev had backed off, no one expected they would be trying a sneak attack or doing something foolish, because I think they recognized at that time, because they didn't have nuclear capability.
Everybody was still very cautious.
Well, they had it, but they didn't have it to the extent that the Americans. I think the Soviet Union recognized that their limited capability would be wiped out in a hurry.
Right. Do you think that the Soviets realized before it got to this point, kind of the very tail end of things, did they realize the American capabilities?
Yes.
They did know that there would be...
I cannot help but believe that Khrushchev recognized the capacity of the United States, mm-hmm, but did not believe they would push it to the brink. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if they had not, and they had embedded those weapons in Cuba, they could have presented a major problem, mm-hmm, to the Americans, because they might well have been able to fire from there before the Americans could do it. Mm-hmm. It was just too close.
Would have given them a slight advantage.
It could have given them a strategic, yeah, advantage. And that appeared to be what Khrushchev was playing.
So for say, we'll say another few weeks afterwards, NATO, and I'm sure the North Atlantic, North American forces were definitely on a heightened state of alert,
yes.
Just in case. Do you recall if there was anything afterwards?
No, it had happened before when Canada went on an increased state of alert. And we usually were, that's with the NORA,
mm-hmm.
which was different from NATO. We usually went in lockstep with the Americans, but we outstepped them occasionally on our different levels of alert that we were on. But I think we went back to the peacetime condition with it quite speedily,
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to raise the fear of the public.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the people in Europe were as concerned about this as the people in North America?
Yes.
They were?